This is CD 6 of an 18 CD set containing sessions from a 4-week course by Ram Dass titled The Yogas of the Bhagavad Gita. This CD contains session number 6 titled Jnana Yoga 2.
My guru was telling me about teaching me about telling the truth, and it led to my going to visit the Supreme Court of Uttar Pradesh, the largest state in India, because the Supreme Court judge had come to the darshan of Maharaji, and Maharaji had done this huge snow job on this man about how important I was, professor from America. He finally got the judge to turn around and say to me, "Well, I'm honored to meet you. Perhaps you'd like to visit the Supreme Court." Now, I had not gone to India to visit Supreme Courts. But what do you do in a social situation like that? And I said, "Well, that would be lovely." And he said, "Tomorrow at 10? And I thought, I'm getting too tight. So I said, "You'll have to ask my guru," figuring he'd get me out of it. And Maharaji said to him, "If Ram Dass said it'll be lovely tomorrow at 10. Maharaji pointed at me like, "Watch it, baby." None of that business. So I went to the court, and I watched a murder trial, and I went through the library, and I talked about the Ramayana to the librarian, and I was in tow of this judge, and even though I was wearing holy clothes and I was a Westerner, it was very confusing to all of the people there. They didn't know whether I was somebody from the United Nations or some whatever. All the lawyers were there in black robes, and they saw me come in with this judge, and I was a Westerner, from obviously an American. So they surrounded me, and they started to ask me about Nixon's China policy, because that was a very hot issue in India at that moment. And I didn't want to appear like we holy men are out of contact, and I read Time magazine. So I gave them a long dissertation on power blocks and realignment of India and Russia and China and blah, 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 and, you know. And then I left. When I went back, Maharaji said, "Well, what happened to the court?" I told him, and every time I tell him one thing, he'd tell me another thing that had happened, because obviously he had been watching one way or another. So I'd say, "I saw a murder trial," he'd say, "Yeah, and there were two judges. That surprised you." And I'd say, "Yeah, that's right." It's funny when he says, what happened, because he knows what happened. You realize it's like Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy. "What happened, Charlie?" Well, that evening, the head of the Bar Association, this man that looked like he came right out of a spy print, a perfect old lawyer type with huge ears and long face, and very barrister looking, arrived to have Maharaji's darshan. He came over to me and he said, "I wonder if you would like to speak to the Rotary Club of Allahabad and to the Honorary Bar Association, Honorary Legal Fraternity." Well, now I'd learned my lesson from the day before, and I said, "No, I wouldn't like to do either of those things." But I said, "I'll do whatever my guru tells me to do." So he goes up to Maharaji, and he says to Maharaji, "We'd like Ram Dass to speak at the Rotary Club and the Bar Association." And Maharaji acted as if we had just been invited into the kingdom of heaven. I've never seen such a put-on in my life. "Ram Dass going to speak at the bar, the Rotary Club?" And he was telling all the Indians, "Ram Dass going to speak at the Rotary Club." And I'm thinking, what is going on here? This is like, I'm going to end up doing the cream vegetable circuit of India. And Maharaji said to me, "What are you going to talk about?" Well, I had hadn't gotten that far, you know, in my reflections, and I said, well, talk about the law as Dharma. Should do it. He says, what else? I said, I don't know. So the lawyer said, Maharaji said to me, are you going to talk about Hanuman, the monkey? A servant of God? He says, that's good. And the lawyer's beginning to look just a little concerned. See? And I said, he said, and you are going to talk about Christ? I said, oh, of course. I'm just beginning to grasp what the game is. The lawyer's looking a little more concerned. And Maharaji says, you going to talk about me? Well, I said, of course. When don't I talk about you? That's good. So the lawyer said, well, we kind of expected that Ramdas might talk about Nixon's China policy. And Maharaji looked shocked, and he said, oh, no. He said, you could never trust him to talk about things like that. He said, he talks only about God. He knows only about God. Ramdas talks only about God. I said, that's right, I talk only about God. At which point the lawyer said, well, maybe then it would be better if you didn't talk to the Rotary Club, and I'll just gather a few lawyers that are interested in talking about God at my home, and you can talk to them, right? And that was the last I ever heard of him. Which gave me my cue for life, which was this note, Ramdas only talks about God. The implication of this note may be that everything I've been talking about isn't God, and why don't I get on with it? Or the implication may be just for all of us to remind ourselves that all of it is God, right? And we're going to get there slowly, as I told you, sort of sneaking up on it. And I think as this lecture goes on, you will understand a little bit more about what that concept means. Also, there was a little confusion last time. I talked about having sat at the Zen Sesshin and gotten incredibly spaced, would be a nice word, and into a spacious stance. I'm learning how to talk the language of Naropa with a basic warmth. And then I said that, it just turned out to be another cheap high. And somebody interpreted that I was saying Zen Buddhism was just another cheap high. And I certainly didn't mean to imply that. What I meant to talk about was that when you have attachments, when the thought forms, the habits of thought are very strongly learned when you're very attached to them, when they are strongly invested, even though you may override them by very intense sadhana practices, such as kundalini yoga, or zen, or meditative techniques, or psychedelics, you will often, most often, re-enter back into those thought forms in a slightly different way, but you'll still re-enter. And were you ready to be all done right away, as was Ramana Maharshi, who at 17 years old had done no sadhana whatsoever, nothing. He hadn't studied particularly. He was just a high school student, and he was just lying on his uncle's study floor, and he suddenly felt that he was going to die. And instead of struggling against death, he surrendered into it, and he experienced that his body was dying, and he saw his body being carried to the burning god and burned. And even though his body had died, and he saw his personality fall away, he experienced intense presence. Now, that is what is similar to what in Zen would be called a Satori experience, or various other labels for it in Hinduism and Buddhism. The only difference between Ramana Maharshi and the rest of us is that he didn't come back. Well, that isn't exactly true. He stayed around for about 40 more years, but who stayed around was different than who was before that happened. That is, he didn't come back into his traditional thought forms. And so, in that sense, it was a non-returnable but for me, at any rate, I won't say anything about you. That Zen experience turned out to be what would be called a minor Satori. And there are some exquisite descriptions of those minor satori's in the back of Kaplow's book, Three Pillars of Zen. The other thing I have to clear up is that all the sweepers in Nainital are actually happy people. Some of those of you that are Marxists in the audience, and others that are realists, that kind of reality, so into the Dharma that they could be a happy sweeper starving to death, and therefore we should not feel anything about that. And that obviously isn't true. All I was saying was that at the time, in India, they divide time periods into yugas, which I mentioned to you were very long periods, some of them as much as 4,300,000 years. And one of the yugas is called the Satyuga, which is a time when truth is so abiding. It's like if you make a deal with a person, you merely say, well, I'll deliver that wood and you'll give me those vegetables. And the word does it. There's no need for lawyers or legal contracts. The whole thing is totally straight. Everybody's just straight with one another. Everybody's living in the spirit, in the Dharma. Under those conditions, the sweeper would be totally content being a sweeper because he would understand the way in which sweeperness was part of his karma. And now it's a mixed bag in India, and in some of the villages, there are many people who do tasks which are very menial, very repetitive, very apparently boring, very hard, paid very poorly, but yet they have a sense of fulfillment because of the way in which they do their task, not in terms of attachment to the fruits of their labor, but just in the doing of the task, and they are doing it dharmically. And part of one of the rich experiences that I receive from living in India, and why I keep going back, is in a way, some of the moments I flash that I am living in the Satyuga again. I flash back where all of the, quote, cynicism, and all of the doubt, and all of the, is gone. And everybody's just right here. And it's fun to check back with that every now and then, to realize human beings can be that way. We've been talking about Jnana Yoga, or the yoga of the intellect, or using the levels of the mind to go beyond thought. And while I'm not, this is not a course in terminology, and I don't think we need to get too deeply into it, reviewing, we talked about the different parts of the nature package that we are under the illusion that we are, and that includes the senses, the indriyas, the lower mind, which is the lower thinking mind that is a tool that's picking up information from the senses. That's called the manas. And the ahankara, which is the loci of all these thought patterns that come together and form what we would call our ego structure, which is our plan of the universe, our model of the world around us. And then beyond that is a thing called the buddhi, which is often referred to in relation to what's called the third eye. And that is the doorway, that's on a pivot, and that is the focusing point which can be pulled down into the ego and the senses, and thus you are totally worldly. But at some point that buddhi, which is an apperceptive operation, can turn inward or upward or outward, since all space metaphors are metaphors. It can turn towards another, quote, place, and I'm using the word place in quotations, another place in oneself, which is the source or the light, which is called the Atman. And I talked last time about a slide projector and the light source being inside, going through a series of slides or veils, which determine what appears to be the screen out there, and that you don't even know whether there is a screen or what's out there. If the veils are too heavy, and the game of all of sadhana is getting rid of those filters, if you will. And the buddhi as a construct, it's a hypothetical construct the way we're using it, as a construct, it's the only part of our nature package that is capable of grasping the higher realms within us, the Atman. And it's called in the Western literature the soul. And in the mystic Christian literature, the statement, when thine eye be single, thy being will be full of light. That is that one we're talking about, the buddhi, when thine eye be single. And while for our discussion it sounds like these are all things or places, I'm not implying that. I'm just using the imagery, because all of that, everything that appears on the screen and all of the processes of looking at the screen, all are projected out from this inner light, from the Atman. And we're going to start to consider what the Atman is or what it's connected to. Now, the game of yoga, union, is then extricating oneself from the illusion of separateness, extricating yourself from identifying with your ahankara, with your manas, with your lower mind, with all the thoughts that are rushing through, with your sense data, with the sense objects. So instead of me and mine and my thoughts and my feelings and my senses, all this stuff is just stuff. And you are slowly getting free of attachment to this. Remember, karma yoga is non-attached activity. You're getting free of attachment and going back inward towards this Atman, where you will rest in the Atman, rest in the light, the undifferentiated, unconditioned light. And we talked last time about using the intellect as a vehicle to get there, using the mind, and what methods were available for using the mind, which I said was the most powerful siddhi, or power tool, that we as biped human beings have at our disposal to get to the Atman, the one unique quality that we have, and we ought to use it. And I did say, however, that it is very trapping, it's very seductive, as all powers are. Every yogic power is a tremendous seduction. Because right until the end, when you are merged back into the Atman, you still think you're somebody. And if you think you're somebody that has an incredible power, you tend to get seduced into wanting to use that power. Even in the nice way, like, with this power, I can do good. Right? And you get into, I'm going to do something about it. Right? So it's true of all methods. All methods are traps. Everyone, I can't find one that isn't yet. Hopefully, the methods, if they're powerful enough, will take you to the point where you will see the trapping element of them and become free of the trap, including the seer of the trap. Now, the first method I mentioned of using the mind is using the intellect, using in problem solving, and I referred to Oppenheimer's example of anybody that does problem solving with their intellect into a narrow enough and pointed enough and laser beam-like enough use of the mind will go right through. It'll take them through, whether you go through in biogenetics or nuclear physics or what. Not long ago, I attended a conference that was put up by John Lilly and Alan Watts for us, a group of us, to meet G. Spencer Brown. G. Spencer Brown is a very colorful fellow from England. He was a don at Oxford. He's a chess blue, or a half chess blue. He's a sports writer. He's many things. And he's written a couple of books. One of them is called Laws of Form. And he's a very acerbic fellow. And he didn't find us interesting enough to stay more than 2 days on the 5-day conference. I was there, and there were a number of mathematicians and logicians, and von Förster was there, and Gregory Bateson was there, and a lot of nice people were there. But he found us all rather dull. And he had an engineering firm, and he was hired by the British Railway to set up a computer program to determine the number of railway wheels that went into a tunnel and came out of the tunnel. They wanted to make sure the same number of railway wheels came out of the tunnel as went into the tunnel, for obvious reasons. And in solving this problem, he found himself using unreal numbers. And he did set up a computer program, and it worked. But then when the British Railway system found out that he was using unreal numbers, they got a bit uneasy, because their boxcars seemed terribly real to them, and their insurance policies couldn't be justified on unreal numbers. And so he started to build an entire following logically back from the railway wheels going in and coming out of the tunnel, all the way back to, logically, the beginning of the sequence from which the railway company would be satisfied. Well, he got carried away with going back and back and back, and he went back to the beginning of the universe. And when he wrote the book Laws of Form, instead of starting from the way he had done it with his mind, he started the other way with the beginning of the universe.
Right.
So he started out with, on the first page, in the beginning there is nothing. And the first thing is you make a distinction. He drew a line down the middle of the page between the differentiated state and the non-differentiated state. That's the first thing that happens with a few more, very few more assumptions. And later he comes to building values and ethics and so on. But then in a footnote he said, it's an interesting footnote, he said, of course, he said, the first distinction, in order to make a distinction between this and that, you must have some kind of a value system on which you can differentiate this from that, like darker or lighter or better or worse, or this is that, or right or left, or whatever. And he said, and since, of course, before the first distinction was made, there was no value system on which to make the first distinction, in fact, the first distinction was never made. Therefore, this book is written to describe a universe that would exist had the first distinction been made. Well, that's the one, see. Now, if you can handle that footnote, you're already through the door. See? If you balk, see, there you are clinging. You're clinging to thinking that you're real and that it's really happening. So that is the use of the intellect, if you will, through logic, just going in and in and in and back and back and back. Then I talked about the use of paradox and the koan in Zen and how paradox or contradiction generates another level of consciousness. It forces you back in or back up through just facing a paradoxical element in order to bring it to a resolution. Then I talked about injunctives, that is, where you accept an instruction that says, do this, do that, and a specific example I gave was Ramana Maharshi and the method of Vichara Atma, or who am I? And he gives you instructions. You ask, who am I? And then you say, I am not this. And then you experience that. I am not this. And you experience that. I am not this. And it's a set of injunctions. Do this, do this, do this. And it'll take you through if you just follow the instructions. But you need incredible discipline of mind to be able to follow it. It's a technique of slowly pulling the rug out from under you by following instructions, in which the last instruction, of course, is stop following these instructions. And then the methods of study and contemplation, studying, for example, the Gita, or specifically studying literature that has been written from somebody who is residing comfortably in the place you don't reside, the Atman. That is, it's best to read the words of beings who are it, and I use all these words very gently, like a Christ or a Buddha, or a third patriarch of Zen, or Tilopa, or Krishna, in this case. Just taking these words and letting them filter through you by taking them like shloka by shloka and contemplating upon them, working with them, starting to identify, feeling your way into it. It's the way I suggested you read the Gita for the third time. First time you read it as a story, the second time you read it as if you're Arjuna, the third time you read it as if you're Krishna. And then also using the mind is using very analytic techniques of studying your own process of existence and using that analytic process to keep extricating you from the process of itself. And that is what the Abhidhamma is about, which is the Buddhist psychology, which is an exquisite category system. It's like having a desk. Those of you that like working with keyhole with desks that have little places to put paper clips and rubber bands, and if you have that kind of obsessive compulsive nature, you will absolutely delight in the Abhidhamma, because the Abhidhamma there's not one thing you could think of putting anywhere for which there isn't a place to put it. There are little places underneath and little places around back, and there are secret doors, and it's an incredible desk. And what's good is you can get rid of everything so your desktop is perfectly clean, okay? Which is your mind, or the no mind, or whatever, because there's a place for the concept of the mind, see, that goes there. And it's an exquisite analytic device. And you get so that you work with it so well when you get into something like Satipatthana Vipassana, you get so good at the category system in your mind. You know where every keyhole works, you know, that something appears on your desk and automatically your hand reaches out and puts it in the right place. And your desk is always clear. And that's using the mind. It's using your mind to beat your mind, if you will. It's like if you you have a thought, and you think, it's my thought, and then you say, oh no, it's actually category 463 sub 2. Okay. It tends to depersonalize, tends to take the romance out of it all. The romance out of your personality predicament of, I'm really somebody. Oh, that one. Well, that one obviously is a... Right. So what we are talking about in this method of wisdom, or in all methods of yoga, is extricating oneself from the attachment to the illusion of a permanent somebody doing something in the world. Getting one free of doing a take of yourself in nature. Being attached to the gunas, or the threads that compose the physical plane world. Lovely line by Ramana Maharshi. If it is said that liberation is of three kinds, with form or without form, then let me tell you that the extinction of the three forms of liberation is the only true liberation. That you keep having mind models about where you're going, but ultimately the models themselves have to go too. Because as Ram Tirth said, a God defined is a God confined. Now, if you follow this mind these mind methods through, a number of things happen. One is you begin to sense a deeper way of knowing things. And you start to come into what we've been calling intuition, or an intuitive relation to the universe. And this is very hard for somebody that is used to knowing what they know as objective knowledge to deal with what this intuitive grasp is. It's an inner feeling of, yeah, right, that's the way it is. And my first knowledgeable memory experience of this, where I honored it at all because of its validity and power, was the first time I took psilocybin. When that happened, when I was ripped away from being the knower of objective knowledge and seeing the entire world outside or from outside, even thinking of myself as an object, when I got into this inner space, the power of it was such that there is a part of me that never returned from that moment. Now, a lot of me did return, and pretty soon that experience, a few days later, as I said about the Zen experience, was a cheap high. It was another memory of something that had happened before. But even though that memory was just weakening, the memory, the experience itself had such a powerful sense of validity to it that there wasn't a chance that it was going to be completely lost back into the Akash. And it's as if once this quote, thing happens to you, once there is the breakthrough, once you have started to experience another way of relating to the universe than the way you have built up the model of how you would relate were you who you think you are, once this thing breaks through, you are literally never the same again, because though you are back in the illusion and you will get sucked into thinking it's real many times, a seed has been planted. The seed has been planted. The awakening has begun. The flip has occurred. And from then on, it's merely a cleanup operation. It may take a number of lifetimes, but it's still just a cleanup operation. And in a way, almost by definition, what brings everybody into this room, into Naropa Institute, is the fact that at some level or other, this thing has happened to each being here. It may not have happened by any method you can even label. Or maybe for some of you, all because of your particular karma, all the way through your life, you've been flipping in and out of these things, but every time you got into one of these spaces, you labeled yourself as insane. Like, I received letters from people in northern Canada. A fellow will say, somebody left your book when they were passing through, and it was the first time I realized I wasn't crazy. Because this stuff's been happening to me all my life. But all the time I thought I was insane. And I never told anybody about any of this. Because it didn't fit in. It wasn't... along with the total conspiracy of mind that we call our culture. And once this awareness of another identity in oneself has occurred, then the whole meaning of worldly desires starts to change. It's like you've been collecting baseball cards. You're 12 years old, and you've been collecting or dolls, if you're a girl, if you'd like a culture-bound thing, but now with women's liberation. We will assume that everybody collects baseball cards and everybody collects dolls, okay? So these are dolls of baseball players, all right? And you've been, to keep everybody cool, and you've been collecting these, all right? And you're doing fine. You've got the best collection around, and you're very upset because somebody else has one, a doll that you really want. If I give them three of this for one of that, will they do it? Or you know, if I shovel their walk, maybe they'll give me that, you know. And it's all terribly meaningful to you. And then one day you are sitting or walking or sitting on the bus next to another entity. And there is something that occurs in the vibrational chemistry between the two of you, subtle though it may be, undefined, that makes baseball dolls suddenly irrelevant. Right? It's generally called the onset of puberty. Right? And once that has occurred, if you then next day, see, you've been going to a therapist to get over your preoccupation with baseball dolls, all right? Now this thing has happened to you, and the next day you go back to your therapist, and your therapist says, now I realize how terrible a problem this is, and we will work on it, and I have hope that in a year you'll be able to see the light. And you say, ah, the whole thing's irrelevant. And the therapist says, that's a dissociative response. That's because you're so preoccupied with baseball dolls, you don't want to admit it, so you're acting as if it's irrelevant. And you say, no, no, it's really irrelevant. You know, I've just completely lost my interest in baseball dolls. But see, the analyst is prepubescent, right? Which puts him in a peculiar position, or her, to keep the whole game straight. Because how is he or she going to know that you are not saying all that as a dissociative process, as a defense mechanism, because you are so preoccupied? You've flipped over the edge now. See? You couldn't get the baseball doll you wanted, and it was so horrible to you that you went the next level of defense and you said, I don't want the damn baseball doll, right? How does he know it isn't that one, right? He doesn't. Because from his experience, every time somebody says that, when they've wanted it so much, it is that. Right? That's our predicament. You see, that's the one, to he who knows, no explanation is necessary. To he who doesn't, none is possible. And that is exactly the kind of wisdom we're playing with now. We're really talking about a discontinuity of consciousness. You will allow that image. It's that beautiful, beautiful story, which is dubious whether it's a Sufi or a Hasid story, about the king and his wise man. And the wise man says to the king, Sire, I'm sorry to have to tell you, but the entire wheat crop for this year has been ruined. Probably it's ergot poisoning. And he says, and everybody that takes this wheat is going to go mad. But he said, fortunately, I've set aside enough of last year's wheat for you, since you're the king, and for me, since I'm your wise man. So the king reflected about this for quite a while, and then he said, well, what would be the advantage in being a sane king of a mad kingdom? If all my subjects are mad, why would I want to stay sane? So I'll tell you what, I think I'll take the wheat along with all of my subjects, and you will too. Then the king said, but you know, it would be nice if we could remember this moment when we decided to go mad. The wise man said, well, whatever for, sire? And the king said, well, it might help somebody. Maybe it'll help us later on or somebody else. Who knows? So the king thought about it. He said, I'll tell you what, we'll put a mark on each other's foreheads, so that every time when we're going around mad and we meet each other, we'll look and we'll know we're mad. Okay? Right. Well, that's the predicament. Like, you are living totally in this most grotesque illusion. I mean, if you would like me to give examples of the grotesquerie of life, you know, it's okay, you'll accept it without my doing it to you. Buddha has a number of examples of that, you know. But this incredible dukkha, this incredible stuff, you know. Right in the middle of it, you meet another person and you look in their eyes and there's the mark of madness. They're saying, here we are, we're crazy. Like, are you here? I'm here. Well, here we are. Isn't this incredible? Okay. There is a recognition that begins to develop among people who have passed through puberty. You know, even though we're exchanging baseball dolls. But it's more like exchanging baseball dolls. It's not like exchanging baseball dolls. Okay. You can always tell when somebody comes up to you and says, I have this trouble, and you say, gee, that must be a terrible problem. They say, I don't feel you're taking me seriously. No, you don't really understand, you know. I'm trying to give you the flavor of the discontinuity when the game changes, when the thing flips around and the whole picture starts to become slightly different. It gets a little weird at the early stages when you start to become discontinuous because you're flipping back and forth often at a great rate. Because when you're in it, you're really in it. And when you're not in it, whatever it is, you're not either way it is. You're going back and forth and it's pretty hellish at times. I was once giving a lecture at the committee on Broadway in San Francisco. And I had taken a lot of acid out at Half Moon Bay in the afternoon. And when I got to the lecture hall, I unfortunately hadn't timed it quite right. And I was peaking. And I stood up on the lecture platform and I looked out and all I saw were ocean waves. There weren't any people in the hall. And it was a question and answer lecture. This thing came up out of the ocean, which I acknowledged it, and it stood up, and it was wearing a tie and a jacket and a vest, and it said, would you please comment on the... it was the LSD days, by the way. Would you please comment on the hypothalamus as the significant vehicle in the working of LSD and talk about the synaptic theory of neural interaction. And what I saw, you wouldn't believe. I mean, it was just amazing. It was like this fish that was coming out of the water and saying, do you love me? Yeah. So I answered as best I could, and I said, I love you. To which the fish replied, that answer is not satisfactory. At which point I started to what is known as bad trip. Figuring I better get down quick. And I then spent 15 minutes trying to answer his question with sweat pouring out of my... Now, what is this other domain or focus of energy or non-domain or whatever it is or isn't that one enters or doesn't enter into? You see the predicament now. I mean, I'm sure you're aware of it, that it's easy to talk about it from this end there, assuming this is this. It's very different to talk about it from there this, see, because it can't be said and it can't be whistled either. See? So the predicament is we are going to talk about the unspeakable, which is the Brahman, which is that light inside, which is the one of the universe, which is the ultimate illusion, which is, look, these are all little places we're saying it from here. Right? And as I've suggested, once you have touched or tasted or sensed or intuited or everything turns out to be different. And at first, you're completely hooked on one plane of reality, but the minute you've flipped your television receiver dial and you realize that although there's only advertisements on this station, on this other station, which you didn't even know existed, there is the most incredible programming. Then the question is how quickly, how much you want to come back to the old program again. And there is a very beautiful devotional text about the Gita by Jnaneshwar, which is put out by George Allen and Unwin. It's very lush, and from now on, again, I'd like to read you little parts of it. O Arjuna, he who has reached the state of this place, as a high mountain cannot be washed away by a flood which is a mirage, so he who is not affected by weal or woe. Once you start to enter into this other channel, baseball dolls don't get to you. Is it any wonder that one who does not wish to forego the bliss quality, we'll take time about qualities, but remember, they've all got to be let go of. They're just, from this end, we're talking about them, qualities. Is it any wonder that one who does not wish to go the bliss of the self in order to return to the domination of the senses takes no pleasures any longer in objects of sense? Enjoying to the full the bliss of the self once his heart is established in it, he will never leave it. Will the Chakora bird feeds on moonbeams. Will the Chakora bird lick the sand when it's among the bed of lotus flowers and it has once fed on the clear beams of the moon? Now, thy curiosity will certainly prompt thee to think, who then are deluded? Who's still stuck? Who's busy collecting baseball dolls? They indeed who do not know themselves, they don't know what the real scene is about. They haven't the sort of discrimination to discriminate the, quote, real, which is always with a capital R, from the unreal, with a small u. They indulge in the pleasures of sense as a hungry man will eat husks, or as a deer afflicted with thirst and in its distraction forgetting to look for water will rush to a mirage in the desert. I mean, once you've been in this place, will shade of clouds afford protection against the wind, rain, and heat when you have a beautiful house to live in? Would a serpent's hood be cool enough for a mouse? I'm just going to start to introduce you to the... O son of Pandu, as the piece of bait, that's the desire out there, attached to a hook is good so long as it is not eaten by the fish, so it is with all contact with sense objects. That is, once this thing is started, you see sense objects in an entirely different way. Because if you've tasted, it's like you go out and you buy a new Mercedes-Benz, and then you're getting the rush off driving your new Mercedes-Benz. Or whatever your trip is, you cook a bouillabaisse, and you get the first bite of bouillabaisse, and is it good? Or you are involved in an exquisite sexual dance and you come to the moment, the long period of the timeless moment of foreplay. Now, as long as those are the ways in which you come to, let's say that of all those things, there is some communality about them, that they all touch a moment where you feel fulfilled. Yeah, right. You're working from a place of peace. I mean, usually when you're in the midst of making love, you don't want a root beer. Okay? Or if you're a root beer freak, when you're drinking the root beer, you may not want to be making love. Because when you're getting what it is, as you're driving the Mercedes, whatever it is, there is that moment of enoughness. Instead of more is better, suddenly enough is enough. And right here, and it's enough. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mm. Now, the root beer is going to turn warm, or it's going to go dead, or it's going to, you're going to finish it. And everything else out there is in time, and it's going to pass. So what you do is you get very hooked on manipulating your objects. You get a little of this, a little of that, and then you'll finish with this and try that. And after the root beer, we'll have the pizza, and then we'll go to bed. And then after we go to bed, we'll have a cigarette, and then we'll go to sleep. We'll get up and we'll have that morning coffee, and then we'll sit in the sun, and then we'll read that book, and then, and on and on and on. And it's just a little bit, because we're trying to we're getting to be masters of controlling the environment because we think the game is man over nature, man over the collection of baseball dolls, in order to optimize that moment. Now what happens is, by some weird concatenation of events, you suddenly find that that moment turns out to be residing right where you are when you stop freaking so bad. And it turns out you are that moment. And that all of these little things were like, you get a dollop of bliss for that, and a dollop and a half of bliss for that, and a half a dollop of bliss for that. How about if you can have the whole bag? We give our cat a handful of cat food, but we put the cat food in a bag under the sink, and during the night the cat opens the sink door and goes in and eats all the cat food at once. Then in the morning it meows like it hasn't had any cat food. It took us weeks to figure out how the cat was getting so fat. Because once you know where the cat food is, see, the whole trip is different. The anxiety starts to dissipate a little bit. You're not worried that if you get to the root beer, the refrigerator, the root beer will all be gone, because it would be okay. I promised I would stop. I have a hard time. I have such a huge ego that I can never stop talking. I came back from India the first time in 68. I had been silent for 6 months. So you can imagine how it was then. And the first lecture was at Wesleyan University, and I started at 7:30 in the evening, and at 4:15 in the morning I was still going. Well, I do nothing. God does everything. Questions? Yes. No, you don't. You're just stretching. No questions. Totally fulfilled. That's far out. Yes. What is the relationship between the word intuition, as I'm using it, and the word wisdom? Well, both of them are turning into very sloppy words because they're both used in dozens of different ways. The way in which I'm playing with this stuff is that there is the analytic, logical, reasoning being who does one kind of collection of sequential knowledge. And then there is a way in which you relate to the universe and thereby know something, which you know it like in your guts or in your blood. It's like the way example I've used before is, you know how to make a fist even though you don't conceptually know how to make a fist. Right? And it's non-conceptual appreciation of something in the way that we used the word grok last time, of grokking it or becoming one with it. You intuit its validity. You feel a sense of rightness. It has an affective and emotional component with it too. As you are more and more detached from your personal trip, what you are intuiting is more and more the wisdom, the higher wisdom, the yana, the higher understanding of things. At first, like somebody will say, Ramdas, you say listen to your heart, but I don't know which voice to listen to inside, because there are so many and they're all screaming, I'm the one. And the answer, of course, is that right until the very end, you're always going to get lost in the ego taking over these channels and using them in order to preserve itself. And what you're going to get out of those isn't the higher wisdom. It's just going to be another shuck, right? But that is a vehicle through to the higher wisdom. And the higher wisdom is what I've been talking about, which is the realization that you aren't who you thought you were, and the realization that there is a... The word subjective isn't an appropriate word, but I'll use it anyway. There is a subjective universe, a unitive universe that lies behind the objective universe, the knowable universe. That when you be wisdom, it's different from knowing knowledge. And intuition is the doorway through to that being wisdom. It's through to that place where you are wisdom. Yeah, the question is, how do you discriminate between those different trips? It's not easy. And in fact, very often, as I said last time, there are two strategies. One is to treat every one of them as phony. Any message, just keep getting rid of messages. Just a general strategy of I won't trust anybody, total paranoia, right? The other strategy is to take the one that feels most valid, get up and act on it, and you will immediately fall on your face, which will make you realize that was another wrong one. Brush yourself off and you listen again and you go again. You're never going to have the assurance that this is the right one, because any one you think this is the right one isn't by definition, really, because of the place from which you're asking. So what you do is you just keep error. It's like trial and error. And there's one way. This is free energy, by the way. You pass that up your spine. That's provided by the city of Boulder. It's free shakti part. Okay, don't get hung up. And it's not an obstacle. It's not an interference. It's God's grace. Were there a God to give grace? Watch it. And the way you realize error is because you will notice as you start to act on what you thought was your intuition that you're just getting deeper into the mire of stuff. You'll feel the heaviness and the attachment and so on. You know you made another mistake. Your guru could tell you to hell freeze though, but if you're not ready to hear, you won't hear. And if you're ready to hear, a leaf falling off a tree will tell you the same thing. It's nice to have a guru. He says, that intuition's full of crap. But you may end up saying, so is he. See, you don't know. Depends on what stage of your own evolution you are. Yes. The question was, is there anything you can do to sharpen the intuitive process? You quiet the mind. You study the words of beings who are speaking from that other place, who know. And that tunes you to that place more. It's a tuning device. Study and contemplation is a tuning device, is really what it is. And then we're going to talk later about the heart as the vehicle for doing that too. Those three things come to mind immediately. Yes. The question is, when people come together, literally or whatever level you want to take it, how do you understand that from a karmic point of view? Well, it is so profound. The most profound way I can say it is that you wouldn't notice anything at all in the universe were it not lawfully built into you as a elusive entity. That set of attachments that makes you perceive, A, on the level at which that other entity exists, and B, that other entity from among all the other entities. That is, it is the unfolding of your law that determines your perceptual universe, including who you notice and who you don't, and it is the karmic predicament of the other entity, loci of energy, that they in turn see you. So the fact that you even cognize one another, or perceive one another, is already an incredible merging of karma. And since everything is related to everything else in the universe, the event of the two entities coming together is lawfully related. So it only appears to be far out us meeting now. Isn't this an incredible chance? No, it isn't. It's just the way it is. It's just the way it is. And as you meet, the fact that the other person looks at you a certain way is their law unfolding, and the fact that that look affects you in a certain way, it's just like animals with instincts running off, with innate releasing mechanisms and key stimuli eliciting response mechanisms. It's all just runoff, really. We are each other's karmic runoff. You are my karma and I am yours, is one way of saying it. And no matter how romantic the moment might get, it is a function of the lawful working out of stuff through the presence and existence of one another.
Yes. The question is, if all of this is illusion, what can happen here? What can we hear you say? This is using the thorn to remove the thorn with the realization that both thorns will ultimately turn out to be discardable. Yeah, well, that's the predicament. The fact is that you and I are meeting within a stage show, and within this stage show, we are exchanging whatever it is we're exchanging. And it may be that if you get caught in thinking that it is something I'm going to say, see, I'm not caught in that. Words are birds. They just fly through the sky. Who knows where they're coming from and who knows where they're going? And I just have so many pounds of them, and I'll just keep... I'm not attached to them. You know, they're just stuff as far as I'm concerned. In the process of our going through this, something happens sometimes to somebody. Otherwise, I guess somebody wouldn't be here. Or maybe you just get, like as Swami Ram Das once said, you do sadhana, you do a method until you realize it's not going to work. And it's only in what Trungpa talks about, the utter hopelessness of your predicament of getting out of the illusion from in the illusion. And maybe all this is going to create despair. The question concerns what the word illusion could mean, since we are making discriminations within illusion. And does illusion have a pejorative connotation, a kind of a put-downy, negative connotation? There is nothing of this plane of energy and patternings of energy on this pattern that's called the plane that is any more or less real than patternings on any other planes of reality, quote, unquote. What I am working with are what would be called relativistic realities. And I am using the word illusion within the Gyan Yoga framework, that is the framework of using the intellect to get out, as a strategy to extricate you from identifying with a specific plane of reality. And by considering that plane as a show or a stage or an illusion or a play of mind, it starts to lose its hold or its power over you. And you're doing it from within it. You're decathecting it, if you will, from inside of itself. As you come into another plane, quote, that one also turns out to be roughly the same sort of thingness or non-thingness. And the ultimate predicament is that there is nowhere to stand, and that it all, everything we can conceive of or experience in planes, is equally real or unreal. All right? So that the term illusion and the pejorative suggestion is all within what would be known as the Gyan Yoga method. It's not the devotional method, as somebody has already pointed out, by saying, where does devotion fit in to this cynicism? This is a method I'm talking about that Krishna is talking about of acquiring the higher wisdom. And it's a specific method. Okay? Yes. The question of this madness, that this common mark of madness that leads to us and them. If you're still in us and them, you're still... The question is that another illusion? Sure, it is, of course. That's on the way, you get caught in these places along the way. Yes. How do you relate the higher states of consciousness that you can get into to your everyday ego life? Well, there's nothing... The implication of the way you said it is there's something to do about it. The doing about it is from within the everyday ego life. As this transformation occurs more and more, you rest more and more in the space, which we can metaphorically talk about as within yourself, from which there is nothing to do, but in addition, nothing is left undone. And so you will begin to see, and that is coming up in the next discussion, the way in which residing in this, quote, Atman or Brahman, then manifests back into action in the everyday life, into how you become the Dharma, or how the actions relate to another referential group, really, rather than you as a separate ego entity. So that ego becomes merely a like a blue shirt, because you are nirguna, you are beyond the gunas, you are beyond being attached to the forms in nature. You're working with the play of them, rather than being caught in identity with them.
Okay.
Yes. Can I equate Jung's idea of the collective unconscious with the higher wisdom? It's not the whole ball of wax. It is short of the ultimate mystical union, or the one, but it is definitely discontinuous with the normal waking consciousness. It's not arrived at through reasoning or logic. It is a type of knowledge that is available within us, but it's only available in us when we surrender a certain stance of knowing in order to experience a deeper identity, if you will. As those of you that know, the collective unconscious concerns what Jung interpreted as vestigial memories of racial history, along with personal memories over large time spans. Mainly, he's not been involved in the reincarnation personal much as the, quote, collective, that which is common to all of us. And that is going to lead us to a very, very interesting dialogue where finally the tennis match is going to take on a little more color. But rather than doing that particular fastball today, we'll save that, okay? Yes. Would I comment a little bit more on free will and determinism as it relates to karma? Well, thus far what we've said about it, there is more later to be said, but thus far what we've said is that within the realm of baseball doll world, there is the experience of free will. That is, you this morning experienced that you, as that body and that personality, got up, made a decision of what to eat, what to wear, where to go, and so on. And you experience that as if you had the choice to not do any of that. So you experience free will. So that on that particular channel of the television set, everybody on it thinks they have free will. As you move into this other plane of knowing, this one of the aspects of this other plane of knowing, as you're going through, you go from the physical through astral through causal planes. These are different vibrational rates or planes. And as you get into the causal planes, the planes of seeing the relationships in the universe, where you stand back a little bit from nature, still lawfully, you see law. Everywhere you look, you see law. And it's easy. You see it out there in a tree or in a flower. But then you look back into your own mind, your own thoughts, your own decisions, and you see law there too. And you realize that the thoughts you thought you were deciding to think, all that deciding was lawful. It was not outside the law, all right? So that from this other vantage point, you now experience that what you thought was free will was in fact only what you thought was free will. And that from this other place, it is all lawful. That is, it's only apparently, quote, free, meaning free independent of some organized structure of events where past, present, and future are all lawfully related. Now, shortly we are going to get to the next level of the dance, where once again we start to deal with the concept of freedom. So it's like a sandwich where the two pieces of bread are freedom and in between is law, right? But that which is free of the law on the other end, that's a very, 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 very subtle, far-out concept, and I got to move at that slowly, if you will. At this stage, is it correct to think that you can make mistakes in judgment? The answer is yes and no. Because I don't know which level you want to talk at. You hear that? The question was, there's some confusion about the way I use the word satisfaction, as once you've given up the baseball dolls because you're getting, quote, more satisfaction. I ain't got no satisfaction. Now you got the satisfaction, more satisfaction. Right? Each of the adjectives that describes what that state or that particular quality of experience is about turns out to be inadequate. And it is not somebody experiencing satisfaction. I am satisfied. Whatever the quality is of enoughness or fulfillment or presence or peace or, it's that moment between the past and the future. It's right in here. Because the dissatisfaction always comes from the relation in time, waiting for the, or remembering, you know, you understand what I'm saying? So that right here, that's the quality of it. Now, so it isn't satisfaction in the lower sense of satisfaction at all. It isn't the big ice cream cone in the sky, it's the essence of the big ice cream cone in the sky. It's the essence of all ice cream cones. It's ice cream cone essence, okay? All right. We'll play more with that. Next time we have a whole discussion on Brahman, the state of Brahman. Finally getting to Nirvana. And then what? Oh, it's such fun. This is like a long, long delayed gratification trip.